3JCA monitoring 610.
N4ZLK,
where are you calling?
Shane, N4ZLK, spoke to you this morning. How are you this evening?
Just figured I was on Skyward monitoring it for a while. They kind of went down to the monitor boat, so I jumped back over here. Shane, do you know who's running the net tonight?
Might be Chad, KO4NUE. I think Tuesday night, or his night.
Hear him out here in a little bit. So, I did a pre-check today, and lo and behold, I inadvertently switched my wife's call sign with my daughter's name and put my daughter's, my wife's call sign with my daughter and my daughter's call sign. Wait a minute, let me stop again. I'll get this right here. My wife's call sign is on my daughter's, and my daughter's call sign is on my wife. There we go. Yeah, I was in the hospital yesterday for my heart. Again, and I just came home and I was on some medication and I checked in earlier this morning and I messed things up on the pre-check.
If you get hold of him, I'm sure he'll be happy to switch that up. Are you going to just monitor the net? Do you monitor it at nighttime or are you going to check in?
If I'm awake, I'm going to check in, but I ended up taking my medication just now, so I may be out here in about 20 minutes. But I did the pre-check just in case.
I haven't done the pre-check yet. I know it's a nice feature. So we were talking about Delaware this morning. I looked up Frederick on the map again. Of course, that's, I think it's right north of Milford area. All those, when I was visiting her, when she lived there, down, they were just starting to work on it, so it was 113 or 13 that we would drive up Delaware. It's the Blue Hen Mall. And then, anyway, we drove all over Delaware. It didn't take long.
Yeah, you had another radio or some feedback or something covering you up a little bit. Yeah, 113 in front of the Blue Hen Mall, then down in front of the Dover Air Force Base, and so forth like that. You passed the north gate, the main gate, then the south gate. Then New Base Housing was on the right-hand side. Then you had, on the south end of the base, you had the officers' quarters and stuff like that, the base housing. And, of course, the approach end of the runway, because C-5s came right over the highway. And then just headed on south.
Yeah, I think that was the first time I really had a close-up experience with those C-5s. They would look like they were just hanging in the air if you were driving south and they were coming in. They didn't even look like they were moving. They were massive.
Yeah, I forget what the height off the ground is. I forget how many storage. But I had the pleasure of flying the simulator a couple of times. And I have my pilot's license for like a 140 and a 152 and a 172. So there's a big difference between the cockpit seat and the landing of the runway. So, big difference.
Can you imagine? Those things were massive. But yeah, I got a lot of fond memories of going up there. It was a beautiful area. The first time I'd been to that area. And, you know, totally different from down here. I grew up down here, and just the way the land is laid out and the marshes, and of course they're all filled in now with houses. They filled in a lot of those marshes and built homes in there, but I enjoyed my time visiting there.
Yeah, so that, of course, that's Highway 1 that goes down there now. Then, of course, Lewis is kind of right over there between Seaford and I'm trying to think of the other town there. Bridgeville or something like that, or Bridgetown?
I'm still not familiar with, my wife could tell you. She'd say, yeah, you turn right out of here and she used to go to church in Georgetown, went to school in Georgetown, go to Milford for the dentist, that kind of thing. Greenwood. She's got a good friend whose husband ran a restaurant there in Greenwood for a long time, right there in the, just one light in the little intersection of Greenwood, and had a really, really popular pizza and sub shop there.
Was your wife there at Lewis?
1989, and she was born there, so it's been a little while.
Was there from 79 to almost 2000 in Dover, but I lived in Frederica, and then I moved to Florida, so she probably remembers, what's it called, the June Jam or something?
About that. I have not heard that term, but did you ever get down to the boardwalk in Rehoboth?
Oh, yes, sir. Had a friend of mine that had a yogurt shop down there. It wasn't actually on the boardwalk. It was on one of the side streets, probably maybe a block and a half away from the boardwalk. But it was okay. It was, when I say yogurt, I'm sorry. It was a bagel shop with cream cheese. She made an assortment of variety of different cream cheeses.
Best pizza place there. And it's so famous that I can't recall the name right now. It was there for years. Nicoboli's. Nicoboli's, that was the last name of the people that owned it. And they just closed that down. After probably 40 years of being in business, they just shut the doors this past year, I think.
Wow, I remember Nicoboli's.
Fries, they're on the border. They were pretty popular.
Right on the corner of the boardwalk, weren't they? Like, if you take the main street into Rehoboth, it goes straight out to the beach, and you go around that little circle at the very end, as you came around to the north side of the circle. I thought they, weren't they right there on that one corner there?
I had to say boardwalk, not border. That is correct. That's exactly where they were, right there on the corner.
Does your wife have her amateur license?
That she, her dad had his, and he tried to teach her Morse code and tried to get her interested in it, but she's just never caught the bug. She's fine with me doing it. You know, she enjoys some of the stories I tell her, but she's just never got the bug.
I'll be a control operator one night with her. Let her talk. But, do you remember what her dad's call sign is? Because I was very active in amateur radio back then with the Dover Club and the repeater at the time was at Polytech. I'm not sure where it is now.
He was N3GNY, Golf November Yankee. And then when they moved down here in 1989, he had a bad heart, bad health, and they told him he'd be better off down this way. Back then you had to, when you changed areas, call areas, you had to change your license. And he was actually given this license, N4ZLK, and when he passed on, I was able to get it. But November 3, Golf November Yankee was his call.
I'll have to go back and look and see if I can find if I worked him on the logs. You know, I don't know if he hung around on the 3905 down on HF in the evenings, but that used to be very popular in Delaware, the 3905 net. You know, a lot of Delawareans would check it every night. But the call sounds very familiar.
Technician license, which, let's say they call it a Tech Plus now. He was not able to get the 13 words a minute, and that was, so he could only get on HF, you know, on CW, except for 10 meters. I think he probably could have gotten a waiver, a health waiver. I think they might have had something back then, but he was too stubborn to do that. So he wanted it, and he worked on that code for years, and he made a lot of contacts with Morse code. He just couldn't get past the 13 words or get up to the 13 words a minute, so he would probably not have checked in on the 3905 net.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I was listening to this call. A friend of mine, Jerry, who lives in Houston, some people pronounce it Houston, but it's Houston, his call is N3KRX, so So that was, you know, of course, Jerry, I'm not sure if that was his original call or not, but I want to say Jerry has actually changed his call. I may be wrong, but the last call that I know that he has is in 3KRX.
When he got his call, when he first got his license, I don't, it might have been the early 80s when he first became licensed, but I'm not sure. He had a career with the telephone company. He was a lineman, and he also had FBI clearance for any of, he worked with the state police there, and anytime they had to eavesdrop on anybody for any reason, they were, he was called in to help with that.
JCA, chances are your father-in-law or your dad knew Jerry, because Jerry also worked for the phone company, and he was a lineman at, you know, so, climbed the poles, spliced the tires, wires, but he did all kinds of stuff with the phone company.
I almost guarantee that they probably knew each other. They both worked for the phone company in the state of Delaware. I'm sure everybody knew everybody there at that time. And 4ZLK.
Your wife, if the the diner in Milford, if she ever went to that, there's a diner right there at the major intersection. I don't even know if the little Milford Airport is still there, but there was a church on one corner. The diner was kind of like across the street area or right there next to it. I forget what was on the other two, a bowling alley. And then, of course, there was the Milford Airport and so forth like that, because I used to fly as the airplane I'd rent down there, walk across the street on Sundays to go to church. But during the week, like Jerry and a few other people, we'd always eat at the Milford Diner. It was like just a common place for hams to hang out. Between there, there was also a diner by the railroad tracks in Camden that we used to attend.
Oscar, it's going to be in, I'll be leaving work here in another 30 minutes or so. Hopefully a little bit earlier than that. And hopefully she'll still be awake when I get home. I will certainly ask her about that.
Nope, let me turn this down here. The DMR radio is going off in the background. But yeah, I'll probably be asleep. Like I said, I took my medicine about 15 minutes ago. It is starting to kick in. And I'll probably pass out here. But I'll be up pretty much early in the morning there. So I'll be up 6:10 again tomorrow during the day. I'm trying to get back in the habit of listening to the radio. Kind of take my mind off of just being confined here with the oxygen all the time. Can stare at four walls. KA3JCA.
My father-in-law used the radio to escape and to explore. He'd carry on conversations with people, you know, in CW, and just ask them all kinds of questions about, you know, where they lived and what it was like. So it's kind of a window to the world. Richard, good to talk to you again tonight. I'll listen out for you in the morning. Or tomorrow sometime, I'll try to get in. Try to talk to Beth tonight about this, if I remember, about the diner in Milford. There, I'm sure she knows it. Hope you have a good evening and take care. Good to talk to you again. KA3JAC, I believe, N4ZLK.
Four. Tells it. Yep. Okay, I'm gonna mess yours up just as bad as my. Yeah, mine is JCA, just crazy animal. So, alrighty, Shane, 73KA3JCA.
JCA, yeah, there we go. And mine is N4ZLK. Z comes first, so I did the same thing to yours. Have a good evening, N4ZLK.
Senator Houston, are you saying there was a Sam Houston who was the president of the Texas Republic?
Yeah, I thought it used to be Houston, but everybody that lives there in Delaware said it was Houston, KA3JCA.
2BNG. Oh, well, the people in, well, are we talking Houston, Texas, or Houston somewhere else? Now, in New York City, you've got a Houston Street, which gives the name to the part of Manhattan called Soho. Houston Street. There's a Soho, but I don't know of a Houston, Texas, and I don't know of the Sam Houston, president of the Texas Republic. So, Is it, what are we, which pronunciation are we deciding on? Are they both correct? Like, is it Yosemite or Yosemite?
Yeah, that's a perfect example. Believe it or not, it's Delaware, the state of Delaware. And you get people that still pronounce it, you know, Houston, and you still get people that are new there that pronounce it Houston. But I believe the Delawareans pronounce it as Houston, H-O-U-S-T-O-N, which to me I thought was Houston when I first moved there. So there's just like what was it? I'm trying to think of it. Of course, you have Kissimmee, Florida. There was another, huh, Sally?
Kissimmee.
Oh, yeah, Kissimmee, Florida. You like Kissimmee? Well, you get some people say Kissimmee, and you get Kissimmee and pronounce it. So it's all kinds of word definition. But, yeah, back to Delaware, that's where we were talking about. Shane's wife was from Delaware, so just kind of reminiscing. It's been a while since I've lived up that way. KA3JCA.
Kiss my... Well, all right, never mind. yeah, my Yosemite. Actually, when you think of every other similar word, I don't know, Vegemite, Yosemite. But, yeah, I haven't lived up north in a while either. The last time was more than 10 years ago. I was... Nassau County, Long Island, was the last place up north I lived. So, but, all right, so there's a Houston Street, or there's a Houston, Delaware. I'll have to remember that. And not refer to it Houston like the tourists do. Remember, though, when you're in New York City, don't ask where Houston Street is. They'll know you're from out of town. Just call it an interesting fragment of conversation. I thought I'd comment on it.
Quite all right, sir. Appreciate that. Can I just... I'm trying to hang out there long enough. I don't know if Chad's on yet. Still a little early at 7:38, so... I just want to let him know that I did the pre-check-in for the family, but... I switched the call signs inadvertently for Sally and Ashley. They're backwards, so... Well, if not, he still gets the same count. So, for the pre-check-in for the net tonight, so... Well, it was a pleasure talking to you, sir. It's nice to do that. You mentioned a terminology that I hadn't heard in a while either. That was Vegemite. I had a friend from Australia one time that was over in the States and tried to get me to try that, and I did, and I did not like it.
Exactly. Isn't it basically brewer's yeast made into some kind of goop? I mean, it doesn't even sound like it would be anything and there's something British, which is similar. I'm trying to remember the name of it. But as far as I know, it's yeast.
And I'm actually I got the Google up here. I'm going to Google it real quick, but I honestly don't know what it was, but I didn't care for the smell either. So it was one of those things that, nope, did like it.
Something British called Marmite. Vegemite is slightly salty, slightly bitter, malty, and rich in glutamate, giving it a umami flavor similar to beef bouillon. It's vegan, kosher, and halal. Well, yeah, it would be, because it's basically nothing. But, yeah, apparently that's the Australians like it.
You spread on toast like you do peanut butter and so forth like that, but I never could acquire a taste for it.
The only thing I remember Australian that, is the, what is that beer? Foster's, and it comes in a big can. Like what looks like a 2-liter can of beer. So yeah, get me some of that Foster's beer and some of that Vegemite. But does it say what it is? Yeah, here it says what it is. It's made from leftover brewer's yeast extract with various vegetables and spice additives. Okay, so I guess it's vegetarian. Well, Well, yeah, it said that earlier. It's vegan, kosher, and halal. Okay, good.
I didn't go back looking it up because I thought you had it there when you said that, so, but I actually just hit the enter key, and of course my computer responded, page not available, but so I got to go check and see if I lost my internet here at the house.
Vegemite Cheesy Bites. Kraft makes this. In 2009, Kraft released a new version of Vegemite with Vegemite and Kraft cream cheese. And Vegemite singles, so those Kraft single slice American cheeses with Vegemite, thus creating Vegemite flavored cheese. And there's a Vegemite chocolate too. Let's see, April 2015, Cadbury announces Vegemite flavored block of chocolate. It's Cadbury's Carmelo with Vegemite. Okay, well, Smith's Crisps and a Biscuit, Bagel Crisps. But said it was banned in the U.S., so that was just a rumor.
About that, so. Alrighty. Well, I'm going to go ahead and turn in here. Yeah, I think my internet was down and it's just now starting to come back online. I got pages that are refreshing. So, alrighty, sir. It was a pleasure talking to you. And I was able to, glad to help you fill out the Houston versus Houston for Delaware. So, 73, have a safe journey or travel, or if that's what you're doing, KA3JCA.
KH12 coming.
Comment, go ahead.
Station gets out of here. I was going to throw in another Houston, Houston thing. I grew up in Central Georgia. My aunt lived in Houston County, and wasn't until I started going to school and found out about Houston, Texas, and, you know, was wondering, you know, what's going on there. And lived out in Louisiana and you know, got used to the territorial thing. If I was, if I went out west, it was Houston, and if I come back east, it was Houston. Anyway, I was just sitting here reading the mail and was entertained by that conversation. KM4CHY.
But I'm in Athens, in Georgia, right? Well, now we're going to get into U.S. named or foreign named U.S. cities. What was it? There's a Paris, Texas. Let's see, in upstate New York, there was a, if you go up I-80, until I-81 until it gets halfway to Canada, I think there's a Florida, and there's also a Mexico. So I remember heading north on whatever that road is that heads up into, not Montreal, but probably Toronto. Oh no, Mexico. We're going in the wrong direction. So, yeah, I guess at some point you only have so many names for cities. You got to keep reusing names. Or maybe sometimes the early cartographers had more places on the map like than they had names for. Like there's a 96 South Carolina. Oh, I guess we had 95 place names and 96 points on the map we had a name. So somebody had to come up with, I guess nobody came up with a name.
And, yeah, as far as international cities, you say in Georgia, I guess the only one that comes to mind is Rome, but I'm pretty sure there are others. And my memory's was never real good, and it's not as good as it used to be. So, yeah, I'm no good in that department. But, yeah, run across a few of those like that. But, yeah, it always... when I first heard Houston, Texas, you know, going to school, it's like, what? No, it's spelled Houston. I don't understand. My aunt lived in Houston. just sitting around here and listening to y'all talk, and it was a good time, and just kind of hanging out and relaxing for the evening after a somewhat long day at work, over.
Quite bored or easily amused, because I can't imagine we're that interesting. But, yeah, I'm going to go make something for dinner, or mix up a drink or something. I may actually check into... Well, I did the free check into the net, so I guess I don't actually have to check into the net. I may hang around the net later if I'm still up. I've been tired all day. It could be this heat and not having proper central air conditioning. You know, it starts to wear down at you.
That's a fact. We're thankful we've got the central air, and we've got a laundry room that's got a window unit in it, and it is, I think I'm going to have to see about getting it serviced. We were looking at buying another one, and false man at work said that there are places that he got one serviced, and it was, you know, didn't cost him but like $50 for him to go through it and recharge it and all. So I'll call a couple of local heating and air places and see if I can bring it up to them.
Essential AC here. I got three window air conditionings going. One in either bedroom, one in the living room, those window units. This is, I don't know, whoever redid the electrical or whatever, they did a very... I guess it's not technically it's up to code, it's just stupid. Because I think I actually have as many as 15 outlets on one breaker. All the outlets in this bedroom, all the outlets in the other bedroom, all the outlets in the living room. And it's a 15-amp breaker. I don't know why I haven't been tripping the breaker almost constantly. But if I ever had, the ambition to do it, I would go rewire that, put in at least one more breaker.
Yeah, it was probably up to code one day, but... Yeah, I don't think that many outlets on a breaker would cut it nowadays, that's for sure. And I think this is Glenn here, right? This is Keith, KN4CHY, over in Seneca.
This is Glenn. You got me right. I've talked to you before, I'm sure. After a while, people start to sound the same, and the call signs start to sound the same. Actually, no, not if you listen long enough.
Yours, I get it for a while, and then I don't hear it for a little while, back to the memory thing, I lose it, so I have to be refreshed from time to time.
Memory is the first to go, especially once you, no longer have, like, classes or a job or, whatever else really to take up your time, and you start to, your general cognitive function starts to go down. The memory is the first to go. Did I say the memory is first to go, right? Yeah, the memory is the first to go.
Roger that. When you were saying that, I was thinking the memory is first to go, and I can't remember what the second one was. yeah, I'm still working, but, I kind of... have a focused job, so I get stuff comes to me, and I just take care of it and move on, and then it's, I've always been kind of a subscriber to Inbox Zero, to where you do action items and then you delete it, but I do an inbox everything. I delete nothing, because I'd inevitably have somebody come back to me and, you remember such and such part we did so and so? It's like, nope, don't remember it, but I can look it up for you.
Engineering, I always had the kind of memory that never used to need to take notes. I would always have, for some reason, obscure little details of a dozen little projects. Although getting in the habit of taking notes would have been a lot better. That way you can go back and prove to your supervisor that something was done or wasn't done, or what somebody said they were going to do and didn't do, or whatever it is. But somehow I never got into the habit of being a copious note taker, because, my memory would always serve me well. You know, now, of course, I'm not even sure if I fed the cats today. So that's, you know, that's always the, if you don't keep your mind active, as I said, that's the first to go. And then, you know, general cognitive functioning, I'm sure, soon follows.
CHY's thinking up with the repeater.
Yep.
And I kind of hope to find out. I got probably about another 5 years to go. And we will test that theory once again. And yeah, I'm the same way. I'm not a copious note taker. I've always envied people that that did that and could go back and you know, make sense of it. And that was my problem. Is I'm mostly taking notes as reminders to myself or like to-do lists and stuff like that. And you know, stuff that I write down and then I go back and take care of it and then it's gone. Because I have had to go back and refer some notes and I just didn't quite get the whole point across that I was trying to get across. When I go back and look at them, it's like, yeah, I don't know what that means, or I did tend to do fairly well decently commented computer code, because that's one thing where memory really won't serve. You know, I have, somehow I have old fragments of code on this machine that I wrote 20 or 30 years ago. I look back at it now and I said, who the hell did this? So, you know, the way, I guess the way you would do something now versus years ago changes, plus, you know, your mode of thinking changes or whatever. But that's the one area where I wasn't all that bad. Yeah, I mean, general notes, like having an engineering notebook, where each day you write like a diary, like an engineering diary. Each day you go in there and you write what you want to do that day, or what you didn't complete the previous day. What do you want to do today? What obstacles have you had so far? You know, what obstacles have you had today? You know, who was, and what caused those? Well, you know, this module wasn't ready in time, so I can't test the other module. And that way you have an account of all the, you know, everything you did that day. You know, write down who you talked to about it, write down what the problem was. And on more than one occasion, that might have stopped me from getting fired. If I could have gone back through the notebook and said, yeah, okay, on the 16th, I talked to Jim about the FUBAR module. He said it wasn't ready yet, so I could test these others, and therefore, blah, 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 basically not my fault. But, and another strange thing, too, is you think of most engineering types of having very, very organized minds. But, you know, I was never so much that way. Maybe, like, programming and software engineering almost fall in a different category. Like, they're less rigorous and more right-brained or something. I mean, I could still do the job. I'm sure I could. But, you know, that was like another lifetime ago. Anyway, what was I even talking about? As I said, the memory's the first thing to go. And I guess my problem is, and what you were saying is, yeah, what I need to pay more attention to detail. Because as I'm writing the notes, it's enough to jog my memory for the next day or two to where I can come back to it. But, you know, much more than that, I come back to it, and it's like, what was I thinking? You know, what does this even mean? And I have dabbled in hobby programming. And, yeah, I do believe it is kind of a mindset. You're in that mode of thinking, you know, I guess very logically or very algebraically or however you want to call it. And as long as you get into the habit of documenting while you're going, you do end up with some really nice commented code. Over.
And that's eventually, at least that's what I always did. You know, you start out with little dummy functions that are basically just the function definition. And then, okay, put a block of comments at the beginning of this function. What is it supposed to do? You know, what do you pass to it? What is it supposed to return? What are you supposed to be doing with that data? And then you drop down to the level below that. Okay, now that module becomes another block of comments. And then each of those become more and more comments until actually at some point you have code there. When the comments go down to a low, a sufficiently level of detail, the code pretty much just writes itself. It's like writing a table of contents or an index or something for a book. Or, you know, a list of chapters or whatever. So, you know, that's the only... But funny enough, that's the only endeavor I did where I was really that organized as far as, you know, engineering-type things. Aside from that, I'm generally not a very... You know, in my personal life and many other things, generally not such an organized person, which you would think for an engineer would not be a good trait. But also possible I sucked at my job, you know, but I did do it for a while.
I know exactly what you're talking about because I'm definitely in the same kind of position. It's kind of, my title is process engineer, but I do more applications engineering work now than anything, and I can get that job done, but as far as organized on a personal level, not so much. I think like I said, the programming or it did for me as a hobby anyway, it would end up tending to get me laser focused, and from there I could, you know, even down to error trapping and stuff like that, make sure you covered everything. I've gone back and looked at some of the stuff that I've done, and it's like, kind of like you said, who wrote this? It's like, oh yeah, this is one of my programs. I got into manufacturing and CNC work, and we would still kind of document stuff that needed to be documented, you know, tools and any kind of special instructions we would document right there in the program. So, that kind of focusing like that definitely helps me on the documentation end of it.
Well, you know, those programming languages that are advertised at OS supposed to be structured usually aren't. And the ones that are advertised as supposed to be self-documenting, they certainly aren't. You know, I mean, because they, from what I know of it, a language like COBOL, add principle to interest giving total savings, things like that. Sentences that are written in actually declarative statements. Yeah, programmers really, really, really hate that. we may think that way, but we don't want to really express ourselves that way.
Doubled in COBOL and Fortran back in the day. And, like I said, most of my hobbyist stuff was BASIC and Visual Basic, but all the newer languages have kind of lost me. I used to be pretty decent at little Python and Perl scripting, but hadn't done any serious programming in a long time, so hadn't had a need. I think that's kind of where all the great things happen, is when there's a need to be fulfilled and somebody jumps in there and usually fulfills that need for themselves. And you end up with, you know, the next, don't want to say Microsoft, but you get the idea anyway.
A lot of people out there just do it for the heck of it without any remuneration. I mean, remuneration. You know, look at all the open source stuff that's out there. One of these machines is running Linux. Okay, that's all open source. No one is really making money out of it. You know, the 100 or so packages that come with it,
no one's in, some of which are quite good. No one's really making money on those either. So, that's one of those things I think people do just to mentally challenge themselves. Plus, it looks good on your resume if you're applying for a job, let's say, in the computer sciences. I wrote the Linux 2.4 kernel. I wrote the scheduler and the printer device drivers. You know, so in a lot of cases, maybe it's the students that are writing these things. But again, if there was a point here, you know, so some people get into these sort of fields, I guess, because they genuinely enjoy doing it. And after 5, 10, 20 years, it becomes a job. So that's probably why there's a high turnover rate, or maybe a high burnout rate.
Good examples of that would be, like maker communities, all the prevalence of Arduinos and stuff of that nature on single board computers. And people are starting out younger and younger and that kind of thing. And starting a project that they want to tinker with, and other developers join them before you know it, not necessarily a full-blown product, but something that somebody new can just pick up and dump the code into it, and it works, but then they can go through and if they're so inclined, get into the inner workings and see how it works. That's always been intriguing to me. I've always kind of followed along in the maker community, like Hackaday and those kinds of sites that really keep a close eye on that kind of stuff.
Canada should turn out another generation of coders. I mean, I can almost train one of the smarter apes to do coding. Almost, but not quite. But I suppose it's a useful mental discipline as far as being able to logically organize the process, logically set down the steps needed to do it, you know, what the conditions are or should be or what you want them to be, and be able to treat through and debug it when it goes wrong. So, you know, it teaches patience too as well. It teaches you to be methodical and patient because it's not going to work the way you want it to. I pretty much guarantee you that. You know, and maybe that patience and the methodical approach that you put into programming, debugging, I'm sure that's useful in other disciplines as well. Let's see, my car doesn't start. Well, let's get a flowchart for that. Okay, is there power? Does it crank? Is there fuel flow? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I guess we should teach coding for no other reason than to give kids the mental discipline for figuring these things out.
Definitely, because, like I said, I've never done it professionally. I just got into it back in the late 70s, early 80s, because personal computers were starting to become a thing, and you could. They were becoming accessible to everybody instead of just large corporations, and it always intrigued me, and you're absolutely right that I think it does kind of, I know it helped me in the troubleshooting area, in the manufacturing world. You're a lot more methodical and take logical steps on what could be next that would be the problem. Definitely helped me out in that respect. I think rudimentary coding would be good start for younger kids, that's for sure. Well, what's left to
So back then, whatever you had to do, you had to do fairly efficiently. And I remember, you remember a computer, what was it? It was made by Sinclair. It was a ZX80 or ZX81. A little tiny thing with maybe, I don't know, maybe a kilobyte of core. Or maybe 16 kilobytes if you had a little RAM expansion module. So, all right, what can you do with this at all that you can really... Well, okay, C80 assembly language. I guess I got to teach myself that. Although the basic interpreter that was in there was reasonably efficient, too. And I guess there really was no other high-level language. What did I have then? Something like Commodore 64, maybe. But yeah, or even the Apple II or TRS-80 or any one of those systems. You're not dealing with a lot of resources, so you have to use them very, very, very efficiently. You know, I suppose less of a consideration now, which is why, quite frankly, I think we're starting to see poorly coded. Or maybe not poorly coded, it's just now you have the memory and the CPU cycles to waste. So, if it makes it easier, I guess you trade development time for... You trade efficiency for speed of development.
And, I don't remember the specs on it, but ZX81 is what I started on. That was my very first one, because you could get it for under $100, you know, $99.95 as a kit, and that was my very first one, and, looking back on it nowadays, boy, it was very, not to coin a phrase, but very basic, but it taught me a lot in that line of hobbies, and, yeah, I had, and what got me into it is I had a friend of mine that, he had an Apple, back then, I guess an Apple II or whatever it was out at the time, I don't remember now, I think it was an Apple II that he had, and I was just amazed that, they were not affluent, but, I was not as affluent as they were. It kind of blew me away that he had access to one. Shortly after that, I stumbled on the ZX81. I believe it had 2K to begin with. There was a manufacturer called Nemotech or something like that that had a 64K expansion pack that you could plug on the back. And that would allow you to dump the ROM into the fully addressable space of the Z80. And you could do stuff like the custom fonts and, if you were that deep in machine language, you could actually do custom routines and stuff. I've started learning machine language, but I just never could grasp it over. Remember the, either the original TRS-80 or, and let's see. Oh yeah, they were one of the first to have a floppy drive. The 5 1/4 inch floppy. Hey, they had a hard drive. It was like 10 megabytes or something. 8 or 10 megabytes. Not terabytes, not gigabytes, megabytes. And it was, I don't know, a couple of $1,000s. But yeah, there was a hard drive available. But mostly it was the 5 1/4 inch floppy. For years I had an 8-inch floppy around the house somewhere. Not sure what it was for. It was for one of those. But people were writing useful applications to do useful work on those systems. Was it VisiCalc? What was one of the first spreadsheets? VisiCalc, I think. That was a redo. And people would spend, $2,000 or so on an Apple II system just to get VisiCalc, because that's how very, very, very useful a tool it was. When you think about
just the concept behind a spreadsheet in general, it's like one of the most brilliant concepts ever invented. But simple. You know, simple, brilliant things usually are fairly simple. But whatever happened to those developers anyway, they probably got very little, if any, money out of that. And then, of course, you had Lotus 1, 2, 3 and Excel, and I guess Microsoft and everyone else made all the money, made the money out of it.
For a technology podcast for a while, and they had him on, you know, went through the history of it, and I just found it fascinating, because Vince Calc actually came out on the VX81 also, and I ended up, you know, getting out of a bargain bin or something, and got it home and loaded up, and, you know, set their face with a blank spreadsheet, you know, wondering, well, what's so great about this, and, got to dive into it, and, could see the power of it, and this was, quite a while after it was already on, Apple's, and I don't know if they ever made a Commodore version either, but yeah, got fond memories of that, and then, working for Best Contract Records, Lotus 123, and it's like, man, this stuff has come a long way, and now I can't even imagine using Lotus after using Excel all these years. I do a lot in Excel nowadays, but, you know, there's just been so much functionality, so many more functions and stuff, and just a basic spreadsheet that you can do that. Talking about just looking back on the stuff, what we can do with 2K memory or 8K memory, and now you have gigabytes of RAM, terabyte hard drives, multi-terabyte hard drives. Talking about the hard drives back in those days, I can remember walking into a Radio Shack and seeing it. About what you were talking about, it was like a 5 or 10 megabyte hard drive, and the hard drive itself was as big as the computer and set on top of the computer case. And, walking by and looking at it in amazement, how could anybody afford that? How could anybody ever keep that much storage over? Had to be available at the same time in order to basically for one to sell the other. You know, I go back to the example of spreadsheets only because as a concept, it's extremely simple, yet it's extraordinarily brilliant. Okay, I have a grid of cells. In each cell, I either have nothing, or I have a number, or I have some formula which references the values of other cells, which themselves can reference the values of other cells. And the idea is change one of these cells and recalculate it, and everything that depends on everything everywhere changes. You know, it would have been I don't know how useful a concept it would have been without personal computers. I don't see a spreadsheet running on a mainframe as being any. But so it needed a personal computer to sell it, and the personal computer needed something like a word processor or a spreadsheet in order to sell it. So they needed each other. You know, same thing, I guess, with storage. Without the early hard drives, how useful would desktop computers have become? So, the early history of the industry is a question of all these things, quite fortunately, coming together, the hardware and the software, at pretty much the same time. Because otherwise, there would have been, what's the word I'm looking for? Synergy.
if not for that, you'd have no computer industry, or it wouldn't be what it is now. We waited for, you know, something new to come out back then, but looking back on it, it just seems like the stuff is accelerating so fast. The wife and I had a running joke for a long time. When I'd upgrade a hard drive, she just reminded me of it. Upgrade a hard drive and I'll never have to delete anything again. Because 6 months later, a year later, well, I wonder what kind of bargain I get on you. Pretty larger hard drive. And I always stayed at about the same price point, you know, right around, what was it, a dollar a meg. And every time I went out to get a new hard drive, I could about double my storage for the same value, you know. But, yeah, pretty amazing. Well, anyway, Glenn, I'm going to back out of here. Enjoy the conversation. Good talking to you. The repeater's getting a little noisy. I don't know if things are heating up there or what. I'm not sure what's going on with it. We get some stuff done around here, and we'll let the repeater rest for a little while. And I'll probably jump back in for the dad later. Anyway, good talking to you, 73. Have a good evening, and we'll get you again sometime. Sorry if we get you called by again. KM4CHY, thank you.